Good afternoon, everyone. I will call to order this meeting of the Health, Finance and Policy Committee. Today is February 20. Oh, it isn't February 28th. It's wrong on my agenda. It is March 1st. Oh, it's not Groundhog Day. It is March 1st. So glad to see everybody today. We made it to March. Onward. Okay. First order of business would be to take the roll. Ms. Niederhofer.
Ling.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Eklund.
Eklund, present.
Backer.
Backer, present.
Bonner. Bonner. Bierman.
Present.
Bolden.
Present.
Dameth.
Present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Grinhagen.
Present.
Keel.
Present.
Morrison.
Morrison, present.
Munson.
Present.
Pryor.
Present.
Quam.
Present.
Ryer.
Present.
Schultz.
Present.
Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, present.
All right, we have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Niederhofer. Thank you, everybody. Next order of business is approval of the minutes. Representative Dameth.
Madam Chair, I would like to move the minutes from February 28th.
All right. Thank you, Representative Dameth. The minutes are moved. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? And the minutes are approved. Thank you very much. All right, we have a pretty full agenda today and a lot of food for discussion. So let's get right to it. The first bill that we have on our agenda is House File 2056, Representative Howard. And so he's not on our committee, so the chair will move that House File 2056 be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And there is a DE1 amendment, Representative Howard, and I will move the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape in which the author would like to discuss it. And Representative Howard, would you like us to adopt that first, or would you like to describe it first, your preference?
Madam Chair, either is fine with me. The amendment is a technical amendment to update the bill based on feedback from House Research.
Okay, well, great that you described it. So let's then adopt the bill. Any questions or discussion to the amendment, the DE1 author's amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of adoption of the DE1, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So Representative Howard, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. It's good to be back here with all of you. And I'm back here talking about the importance of affordable prescription drugs, specifically with the bill we heard last year and what I would term as some unfinished business of our great bipartisan work to pass the Alex Smith Insulin Affordability Act. As with Alex Law, I'm hopeful we can take bipartisan action on a bill that will improve our healthcare system for patients and provide important financial relief to families who need it. House File 2056 would place a copay price cap of $25 to help cover Minnesotans to manage three chronic conditions, all of which impact thousands of Minnesotans, all of which come with potential grave consequences if not treated properly, and all where medication and supplies to manage these conditions have skyrocketed in recent years. We're talking about managing diabetes, asthma, and allergy issues such as EpiPens. And insulin in particular, we've had a lot of great discussion and put a big spotlight on the challenges of that price increase. But in addition, asthma is a condition that impacts thousands of Minnesotans, and a recent study showed that the average asthma patient pays almost $2,000 per year in prescriptions. And EpiPens as well is an area where we've seen skyrocketing prices. And so that is where the copay cap would come in. The other piece of this bill that's very important is we would cap the cost of medical supplies to manage these diseases at $50, which is an area of the debate around prescription drugs that merits more attention. As I think you'll hear from testimony, many families are now actually paying more for the medical supplies to manage their condition than the prescription drugs themselves. And that's particularly true for families with children. Patients are sometimes forced to choose inferior methods to manage their conditions, diabetes in particular, because of the cost of medical supplies, like continuous glucose monitors, because they're simply too expensive. And on this point, the American Diabetes Association completed a survey that found that during the pandemic, 15% of people with diabetes who rely on insulin pumps or continuous glucose monitors have delayed refilling these needed supplies during the pandemic. And for those folks, 70% of them cited cost as the reason. And look, this should never happen. The cost and the terms of an insurance company shouldn't dictate treatment. That should be between a patient and their doctor. And this bill will help provide peace of mind to families about the cost of these supplies, and will lead to better healthcare outcomes too, which will save money in our healthcare system. It is worth noting that when Minnesota passed ALEKS law, we were the first in the nation to do so. I'm grateful to see several states have followed suit since we passed it. But as it relates to copay caps, Minnesota is actually falling behind. 20 states and Washington, D.C. Have passed insulin copay caps in particular, and it really runs the gamut, red states, blue states from coast to coast. Washington, Oregon, Utah, Texas, Oklahoma, West Virginia, New York, Maine, you name it, this is an area where we have some catching up to do. Just a couple more points before I turn it over to testifiers. This bill is long overdue. Some version of it has been debated since 2019, and it's time we move forward to get this done on a bipartisan basis, as many other states have done so. And two, because we're lagging other states, this has now been a concept that's been studied, so we can actually have data to inform its impact. Following Colorado's legislation, they were the first to move in this direction. A study reviewed documents from all the health plans in Colorado and found that insulin copay caps either did not impact premiums, or if they did, it was described as negligible. And so lastly, Madam Chair, to be clear, this bill is not a solve-all. We have the ability to regulate state-regulated health plans, but not federally regulated ERISA plans. That would require federal action, which we hope will come to. But that is no excuse for us to sit on our hands. Quite to the contrary, we should be doing everything in our power here in Minnesota to advocate for a health care system that puts patients first. And so let's do that and pass House File 2056. And with that, I would turn it over to my testifiers.
All right. Thank you so much, Representative Howard. So first on my list, I have Quinn Nystrom. Welcome to the committee. If you would just introduce yourself and go ahead and give us your testimony.
Got to get that mute button. Thank you, Chairwoman. My name is Quinn Nystrom, and my brother and I have lived nearly 50 years collectively with type 1 diabetes. There is no cure for type 1, and there's nothing we could have done to prevent it. The American Diabetes Association Standards of Medical Care in Diabetes, often referred to as the Standards of Care, is intended to provide clinicians, researchers, policymakers, and other interested individuals with the components of premier diabetes care, general treatment goals, and tools to evaluate the quality of care. So this really is the gold standard. They have long advocated that someone who is insulin dependent will do the best medically over the short and the long term if they're on a continuous glucose monitor, otherwise known as a CGM, as well as an insulin pump, as well as if they're on a newer insulin, which those are about 20 years old, but we still consider them new. So what's the problem, you may ask? Why are we here today? On a lot of insurance plans, the cost is so high for CGMs and pumps that many people with diabetes opt to not use them because they simply can't afford it. They're just trying to stay alive and pay for insulin. We know that a vial of insulin has increased 1,200% in 20 years. Why the high cost of insulin? You have a vulnerable population who will pay anything for medication that keeps them alive. We have pay for delay issues, virtual monopoly, no generic, patent abuse, barriers to biosimilar entry, PBMs and other middlemen who benefit from a higher list price, and the lobbying power of insulin manufacturers and health insurers. I'm one of the lucky ones, you'd say. I was raised in a middle-class home where my dad is a pharmacist. Once I was out on my own, though, I had to work hard to cover my diabetes-related bills. When I was self-employed and had my health coverage through MinSure, I paid $297 for 2 weeks of insulin. With the pandemic, I lost my contracts and was struggling to figure out how to keep myself alive. My fiance had good health insurance, so he suggested we race to the closest courthouse and get married early so I could get on his insurance. Now that I'm covered by him, I pay $65 every 90 days for my insulin, a miracle. But my pump supplies are still extremely expensive. At the end of January, I needed to get more, and it cost me $289.17. That's for a 90-day supply. For my 90-day supply of continuous glucose monitors, that was another $297 out of pocket. Not everyone has someone that they can marry to get decent health coverage. That is why I'm here today testifying in support of Representative Howard's House File 2056. We need your help to keep people with diabetes safe and alive in Minnesota. And in closing, I just want you to think about this for a minute. Insulin is not just a medicine or a treatment. It is a hormone that every single human needs to survive. We are not here today asking for more than everyone else. We're asking for the same. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Ms. Nystrom. And congratulations on your marriage. And oh my gosh, you are so right to have to, not everybody has someone they can marry for health insurance. Well said. Leah Greenside, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. My name is Leah Greenside. I live in St. Paul with my husband, my 13-year-old son, and my 15-year-old daughter who has type 1 diabetes. I'm a small business owner, and my kids and I get our health insurance through an individual plan through MinSure. We have a gold-level plan through UCare. Last year, I testified in support of this bill, and I'm back testifying again, and that's because my daughter still has diabetes. She will always have diabetes, and the cost of her medications and supplies are still too high. We pay over $1,000 a month for our insurance premiums just for the kids and for me. On top of that, with our deductible and co-insurance, we estimate that we'll pay out of pocket an additional $4,500 for my daughter's diabetes supplies this year. This includes her insulin pump supplies and continuous glucose monitor. Additionally, we estimate we'll spend about $450 this year for insulin, other medications, and endocrinologist visits. I have all the details of all these prices if anyone's interested, but I'm not going to go into them right now. But I just want to emphasize, if the legislature had passed this bill last year, my family would be saving nearly $4,500 in medical expenses this year. So the people and organizations who are against this bill will argue that cost sharing is needed to put downward pressure on the cost of healthcare. But here's the reality. I, as an individual consumer, have essentially no power to do this. And I have been struggling with this for the last few weeks as my daughter's insulin pump is now out of warranty and we need to be getting a new one. I've only been able to find two in-network distributors of her pump, and it's impossible to get the real price of the pump before actually buying it. Most maddening, though, I can't even get the pump at what I found is the lowest cost, which is directly from the manufacturer because the manufacturer is not covered in-network. The manufacturer sells the pump for $5,195. That's the cheapest. But I had to go with UCare's preferred pump vendor, which is Fairview Pharmacy here in Minnesota. The first quote I got from Fairview Pharmacy for the same pump was $12,728. I pushed back. I said, this is absolutely insane compared to what I could get it from the company. And my case was elevated to their diabetes team leader. She got back to me yesterday when I told her I was testifying today. And she let me know that the real price, let's hope, we don't know, is $7,995. So it's still nearly $3,000 more than if I bought it directly from the manufacturer. So our system is broken. It's inefficient. It's not a free market. We need your help. Families like mine need help from the legislature to relieve the burden and cost of diabetes supplies. As Quinn said, if people with diabetes don't manage the disease well, it costs all of us much more money in the long run through hospitalizations and long-term medical complications that are all reflected in our premiums. So I said it last year and I'll say it again, we should not be penny wise and pound foolish when it comes to helping people with chronic conditions manage their diseases. Capping the cost of diabetes supplies and medications will only lead to better health outcomes for thousands of Minnesotans. And it's also a smart long-term investment. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. I see Representative Munson has his hand up. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question, I want to thank the testifiers, first of all, and I want to just get us back onto the bill at hand. This bill is only for the co-payments for prescription drugs and not for equipment. Is that right? I guess it would be for Representative Howard.
Representative Howard.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Munson. This bill would also cover medical equipment. The copay piece would be a $25 copay cap, monthly cap for the medication. The bill would also cap medical supplies, including the continuous glucose monitors and insulin pumps that have been mentioned, and that would be capped at a cost of a $50 amount for the year.
Okay. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam. Thank you for the clarification, Representative Howard. We need major changes in prescription drugs and the equipment and the costs and availability. Absolutely agree with the principle. But I guess the concern I have is that the co-payment being capped, regardless of whether it's the type of drug or the name brand or the actual cost of the equipment, there's really no incentive for people to choose more economical solutions when given that choice, where we used to have multiple copay levels based on their choice for equipment. Sometimes you don't have an option, but was there any discussion on whether you should have different tiers of copays, or is it going to be regardless, you know, if the equipment is generic or, you know, name brand and that kind of thing? Was there any discussion on different tiers of pricing for copays?
Representative Howard?
Madam Chair, Representative Munson, to answer your question, well, first, the big concern is that we want to make sure that cost isn't the main factor in choosing a form of care. And so that's what led us to this bill. Some of my testifiers might have more specific information, but some of these technologies, continuous glucose monitors, insulin pumps, as I understand, there isn't like a generic version of a CGM that can be purchased for, you know, $25 off the shelf. These are advances in technology that have greatly helped folks manage their diabetes, and we're grateful for that, those advances in technology, but they're not cheap. And so what this bill would do is make sure that cost piece isn't the factor. It's the doctor and the patient that's making the making the decision about how best to manage the condition.
And then just one more question, Madam Chair.
Representative Munson.
Thank you. And then is there any change, any thought that company, if we cap the copay, of course, the rest of the cost of that will be pushed on to the insurance pool or the plan, increasing rates. Is there any restriction on insurance plans just dropping certain equipment or drugs because the copays would be so low?
Representative Howard?
Madam Chair, Representative Munson, that has been a version of sort of what we've heard from the insurance plans, but I would say that it's more about kind of a fear factor than what's going to be borne out in experience. And at this point, as I mentioned in my testimony, we have some other states to draw upon their experience. Colorado was the first state to cap copays for insulin. They did not see an impact on premiums. And actually here in Minnesota, to the credit of our health plans, they voluntarily capped copays for insulin at $25 or less over the last several years. And we haven't seen huge impacts on premiums. So I think the balance of the evidence suggests that those costs would be the size and scope of our healthcare system and how our insurance companies operate. I don't think a change like this would have a significant impact on the plans However, it would have a significant impact on those patients.
Okay, thank you.
All right. And of course, if you keep one person out of the hospital because they're getting optimal care, you've saved a whole lot of money, right? I don't know how you figure that in. Representative Bonner.
Thanks for that. You know, I just want to be really clear about something. First of all, for diabetic patients, often there really isn't a whole lot of choice in terms of the options that they have available to them. In fact, very often they are very limited in the options that they have to those that are available on the formulary. And even if we have something like a lower cost option, let's say we have a glucose monitor, for example, that you might want to keep for a little longer, but often companies will discontinue a particular model or they'll discontinue the strips so that now the device itself is no longer usable. So even if we wanted to keep that at a lower cost, we could not do that. I also wanted to mention that, as the chair alluded to, an average hospital stay is about $6,000 to $8,000. A patient who has blood glucose monitoring, who has a pump, for example, can stay out of the hospital, which could happen as much as 2 to 3 times a year. So when you actually do the math, we're saving a considerable amount of money by actually doing the right thing. Not only that, it is the right thing to do because that means that the patient actually has a better quality of life. Their disease is under better management. They're able to go to work, to school, to manage actual everyday life. And I can tell you, as someone who has had a sister who is diabetic since the age of 3, this is a huge concern. We have struggled over years to have conversations with her and with the healthcare organizations about how to best manage her diabetes. And I've seen her end up in the hospital because an insurance company has refused to cover very essential equipment that she needs to best manage her disease, like an insulin pump. So I just really want to be clear that we understand what's at stake here. The health and well-being of real humans is at stake. And when we talk about trading the cost to the insurance company versus the cost of the human life, I just don't know that those are equivalent. Thanks for that.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I have a question for Representative Howard. Representative Howard, where is the Minnesota Medical Association on this, and the Hospital Association, and also the insurance companies? Are they supportive of this bill? Have you worked with them? Where are they at on this?
Representative Howard.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, over the multiple years we've been working on this bill, I've had multiple conversations with those entities, generally about the issue of insulin, in particular with the health plans. You know, they did submit a letter that was, not to be flip, but it was a bit of a copy and paste from their previous letters on legislation like this with opposition. But as I mentioned, the testimony, I think some of the claims that we've heard from the health plans are unfounded, just based on experience from other states.
All right. Representative Grunhagen, one follow-up?
Yeah, one follow-up. Yeah, the my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, Representative Howard, that other states have $30 to $100 copay on these drugs. Also, they're, you know, I've sold health insurance since 1978. And what I find, and I've had some of these high-priced drugs. In fact, one lady is at $20,000 a month. Who's a customer of mine? She has the drug flowing in, and the, you know, between the companies and depending on their income and assets, they have been getting help on those drugs. Like, for instance, I'll just give one more example. The individual who was paying $9,000 for a pill per month, his out of pocket on his plan, on his drug plan, or on his plan, was about $4,700 a year. And by submitting with the drug company, he got them to pay where he only had a $2,500 out of pocket. Have you looked at, I guess I prefer, rather than government coming down with a mandate that, like the insulin bill we addressed, that we'd bring the private sector in to address some of these costs. Because I agree, this can be a hardship, and people need some of these drugs for survival. And I've had people crying at the table about it, but I've had people crying at the table because of the premiums, too. So I know it's a little bit long question, but I hope you get the idea behind this if you want to respond.
All right. Representative Howard, short answer, if you can. I'm going to let Representative Quam ask a question, then we're going to move on.
Just a quick response, Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, and thanks for the question. And I guess what I would say is I think our healthcare system right now is skewed towards those larger entities, and we need to make it a little bit more user-friendly and patient-centered, which I think creating the dependability that this bill would do is the right direction.
All right, thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two things quick. First, your comment about avoiding hospitalization. I think the pharmacogenomic bill would assist in improving there. Hopefully we'll have a hearing on that soon. But I'm looking for a clarification on durable medical equipment. Isn't in this bill, but the supplies for the durable medical equipment would be included in this bill.
Representative Howard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I might ask for House research to help clarify the terminology piece here, but the intent is to make sure to cover the CGMs, the pumps, those related medical supplies, which are covered differently than copay that's often through coinsurance. And so that is what we're after in this bill. But I just want to make sure that I'm getting my definitions correct so you get your question answered, Representative Quam.
Okay, Mr. Chund.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, the new version of the bill defines related medical supplies on lines 18 to 21. So it lists, you know, syringes, insulin pens, insulin pumps, glucometers, and so on. So that is the definition of related medical supplies that is applies to this bill.
All right, thank you, Mr.
Chair. Durable medical, thank you. Durable medical equipment, CPAPs, and other pieces of equipment that are very common have supplies are ongoing. And I just wanted to make sure that this is only specializing for certain medical supplies related to certain conditions, not generally for durable medical equipment supplies.
Representative Quam, that's the next bill. All right. So I think we're ready then to final word, Representative Howard.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I really appreciate the conversation and want to thank our testifiers for bringing the real-world experience that so many Minnesotans are wrestling with this. I think this could be a really impactful way that we help make our healthcare system more responsive to patients, and I hope that we can move forward on it this session. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Howard. So House File 2056, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. Thank you to the testifiers. And thank you, Representative Howard. So the next file is House File 3365, which is my bill. And I do have an author's amendment for it, which is the A1 amendment. And the A1 is just a technical amendment. So I'd like to adopt that, and then I will discuss the bill as amended. So I'm moving the A1, and so I'm moving the bill 3365 to be laid over for possible inclusion, and the A1 amendment to be adopted right now. So any discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? And the amendment is adopted. Thank you. So, members, I think we know we all need health care. Pretty obvious. And the main way we finance healthcare here in the U.S. is through health insurance. So just kind of the basics here. Insurance is our way of shifting the risk of something rare happening that we could not afford on our own. That's the way insurance is supposed to be anyway. For example, we all know we buy homeowners insurance, for example, in case our house burns down. And that homeowners insurance has a deductible. And this, in that context, is a way that companies keep costs down by discouraging small claims. Only larger claims are filed, so there's less administrative burden to process the tiny ones. And the events are rare enough that those out-of-pocket costs are usually manageable. But health care is something that we all need, one way or another. And frankly, the insurance model just doesn't fit for health care. So what we've done here, and the way I think it's for historical reasons, the way health insurance has developed, it really kind of developed on that property and casualty model with the out-of-pockets. And it really just plain old doesn't fit for healthcare, something that we all need a lot of the time, even if we don't get sick. We need preventative healthcare. We are so used to the concept of out-of-pockets that we rarely really stop to ask, why are out-of-pockets a feature of health insurance, and what is their impact on patients and, importantly, on healthcare? Out-of-pockets, of course, do keep the cost of premiums down, and they do this by shifting more of the cost to the health consumer, to the patient. But the effect of out-of-pockets, as we've been hearing with Representative Howard's bill, the effect is far beyond that. It is also to keep people from accessing care, even when they're paying a great deal of money for a health insurance policy. So even if the person, and this is a really important point, even if the person can actually afford the required out-of-pocket payments, sometimes people are deterred from getting care by the very existence of those payments because of the uncertainty, because it complicates healthcare. Or perhaps because of the fact that when they get care, they then have to deal with mounds of confusing paper that explains what they do or don't owe and who paid for what. And I think just about any of us who've used health insurance have been subjected to this. So think about that. Think about the waste that is entailed in that system, the extra time, the extra processing. Even if you don't even talk about the denial of healthcare for people who can't afford to pay for those extra costs. And as a matter of fact, members, I was really surprised to learn this, but it makes sense. Minnesota actually has the highest average out-of-pockets in the nation. Minnesota has the highest average out-of-pockets in the nation. Pretty surprising. We don't think of ourselves that way. We think of ourselves as having good coverage and, you know, good plans, and we have been mostly nonprofit, et cetera, but highest out-of-pockets. So just a little bit of a digression here to talk about the term cost sharing, which we've all been using a lot. Cost sharing. Cost sharing sounds pretty innocuous. It sounds like friends sitting down to lunch and splitting the bill. That's what cost sharing is. Maybe we should change that term. Maybe we should think about terms like entry payment or health barrier payment, or maybe we should call it a dam payment. A dam payment, D-A-M, of course, because it dams up your ability to get health care. So what this bill does, House Bill 3365, as amended, it does away with out-of-pocket payments in all health insurance that is under Minnesota's control. It affects CGIP, the individual and small group markets, and our public health care programs. And of course, as Representative Howard noted, we don't have control over the ERISA plans, which is unfortunately you know, we have that in our market as well. But this bill attempts to impact all of the things that we do have control over. So if we were to do away with all these barrier payments in the insurance market, would premiums rise? Well, of course they would. Of course they would. But at least then the consumer would know that they now have a product that they can actually use. And again, think of all the billing simplification and the administrative savings for the insurers, the providers, and especially for the consumer. So in the public programs, we have these barrier payments as well. And I don't know if you are all aware of that. These barrier payments are small, but the impact of them is very large. So people who qualify for our public programs, Minnesota Care and Medical Assistance, those folks are by definition very low income. And they're not paying what most of us would consider large amounts for their out-of-pockets or barrier payments. But studies show that charging for healthcare, even the small amounts for people with low incomes, results in patients foregoing healthcare and often even necessary healthcare. And this, it seems to me, runs counter to the very reason that we have these programs. We have these programs because we want people to get care that they need and to stay as healthy as possible. So while I don't hold out much hope of really getting rid of all the health barrier payments this year, just to be clear, I'm not completely naive here. I really want to have the discussion on this issue. But I do actually think it is realistic to consider eliminating the barriers in our public programs. So this bill does not yet have a fiscal note, and I am really looking forward to seeing that. But we now have a $9.3 billion surplus. So it seems to me that it is absurd and really actually kind of cruel and counterproductive to keep charging up to $12 a month for drug costs and a $3 copay for a sick visit or a $3.50 copay for a non-emergency ER visit to people who are making less than 133% of the federal poverty guidelines. And just as a reminder, it's about $29,000 a year for a family of three on our medical assistance program. So the picture is similar for Minnesota Care, although those folks make slightly higher incomes, but the barrier payments are also higher. So I know we're going to probably hear a lot of concern about what it would mean to get rid of barrier payments in healthcare, but I really want us to think about this because I believe it really points out how dysfunctional insurance is the way we do it in this country. Because, you know, we could look at Representative Howard's bill and we could say, why is he only picking out these particular drugs? Why is he only picking out these particular items that folks need? And I think he's focusing on those because they impact a lot of people. But if you're not one of those people, you could be someone with a different disease who needs a different drug, who needs a different piece of equipment, and your need is your need. And the idea that we structure our healthcare system, our payment system, to put barriers between people and the necessary care, even when they've paid many thousands of dollars to purchase a policy, is actually a pretty absurd state of affairs. So with that, we do have some testifiers, I think, who would want to make some comments about this. And Quinn Nystrom was kind enough to put herself on the list to make a few comments on this bill. And thank you, Ms. Nystrom. Welcome back. Please introduce yourself again.
Thank you, Madam Chair and the members of the committee. My name is Quinn Nystrom. My brother and I have lived with type 1 diabetes for now nearly 50 years collectively. I'm going to cover some different information for this part that kind of adds to my earlier testimony. You know, diabetes is a chronic disease that requires ongoing treatment for an individual's lifetime. For people who are insulin dependent, they need the insulin and the tools to manage their diabetes to avoid health complications, emergency room visits, in order for them to live. For people with diabetes, we know that their healthcare costs are 2.5 times higher than others. This demonstrates the large financial burden that diabetes puts on individuals and their families. Just here in Minnesota, if we're looking at statistics, nearly 8% of Minnesota adults have type 1 or type 2 diabetes. In Minnesota, there is an economic disparity in diabetes prevalence among working age adults. So over 9% of working age people who live in households earning less than $35,000 per year have diabetes, compared to only 4.9% of working age people in households that earn more than $35,000 per year. About 1 in 4 adults in Minnesota lives in a household that earns less than $35,000 per year. And we know that people of color are more likely to live in poverty. I brought insulin to a complete stranger last week. His name was Matt. We met at the back of a Best Buy parking lot. He was on his last vial of insulin and he had just started a new job. So the out-of-pocket costs were astronomical. This man would have died if he didn't get insulin. I asked him if he wore an insulin pump or continuous glucose monitor. He kind of chuckled and said, "I used to have a guy who would supply me with expired supplies for free, but he can't anymore. So I'm just doing my best on multiple injections a day." You know, here we live in one of the wealthiest countries in the world. In 2022, insulin was discovered over 100 years ago, and we have people who cannot just live a healthy life because they simply can't afford it. And so I'm here testifying in support of House File 3365 because it would eliminate cost sharing altogether for both public and private health plans. Co-pays for care create an undue burden on patients and often mean that patients will sometimes elect not to refill medicine or delay it or get care because they don't know how much the cost will be or they simply can't afford it. So I'm asking today, please join me in supporting House File 3365 so that people like Matt, Leah's daughter, myself, and my brother are able to afford and access life-saving medications. Thank you, Chairwoman.
Thank you very much, Ms. Nystrom. And we have Dan Andreessen. Mr. Andreessen, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, my name is Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, the trade association for the nonprofit insurers of Minnesota, which includes Blue Cross Blue Shield, Health Partners, Medica, Sanford, and UCare. I'd like to start by just reminding the committee about the role of health insurers play in all the markets in the state to help Minnesotans access the care they need. The primary responsibility is to help enrollees spread out the cost, the annual cost of paying their medical bills. Madam Chair, you mentioned that it helps protect an enrollee from, you know, a large medical bill that could be associated with a unexpected, you know, emergency care situation. But it also helps spread out, you know, that full amount so that when you go in and see a doctor for an office visit or a test or procedure, you're not paying that full amount at that one time. The prices paid by enrollees is less than without insurance because health plans help negotiate with providers and drug manufacturers for a discounted rate. Now, instead, with insurance, most of the medical bills paid in the monthly premiums collected by a health plan. After an enrollee has sought medical care, the provider will send a bill to the health plan rather than the patient to pay for the bulk of the charges. Depending on the insurance product, co-pays or co-insurance are also collected and paid to the doctor, hospital, or pharmacy at the time care is delivered. Premiums and out-of-pocket expenses are used to pay healthcare expenses charged by healthcare providers and drug manufacturers. Unfortunately, the cost of care continues to increase year after year. In December, Gallup released results from a survey measuring the state of healthcare in America. 30% of respondents stated that they did not seek medical treatment for an issue because of the prices being charged by providers and drug manufacturers. And 71% responded that their household pays too much for the quality of care that they receive. And we agree that healthcare is expensive and sometimes cost prohibitive, but this is due to the ever-increasing prices charged to patients by doctors, hospitals, and drug manufacturers. The premiums and out-of-pocket costs paid by enrollees is a reflection of the cost to pay for healthcare. And because there's not language in the bill to require providers and manufacturers to reduce the prices they charge, eliminating out-of-pocket costs will require these costs to be shifted to premiums. The approach proposed in House File 3365 will have a significant impact on the fully insured market and is likely to encounter conflicts with the ACA, which sets standard criteria and categories for products sold at each federal level on the state's insurance marketplace. Marketplace plans are categorized by metallic tiers, bronze, silver, gold, and platinum, based on the plan's value and cost, how much an enrollee pays in premiums, and as a share of the care received through deductibles and co-pays varies by these tiers. All ACA-compliant individual and small group plans must fall into one of these metal level ranges. Rather than the approach suggested in 3365, we would urge the committee to work to develop policies to put pressure on the prices being charged by providers and manufacturers to address the root cause of the problem of healthcare affordability. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Andreessen. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I've stated my position on a lot of this stuff in the past. So I won't do that. I will ask you to think, though, okay, why are we in the mess we are in the insurance industry? Look at Obamacare, all the promises that turned out to be lies. The more government it gets involved, the worse things get. We had testimony about PANDAS as HHS. We used to cover it under MCHA. Under Obamacare, it excluded that as essential benefits. And these were desperate people. I know you mean well. Think what the results have been, and I could go all the way back to 1965 if I had to, how government involvement has made things worse and made it more difficult to get the care people need. This is another step that you're well-meaning, but it's the wrong direction. You're going to cause more problems than you're going to solve. Thank you.
Representative Pryor.
All right, thank you. I should be faster on clicking on those. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm interested in this concept because what we've heard from the testimony is that particularly when we're talking about these co-pays, these are actually, in many cases, a barrier to getting care. And as Mr. Andreessen was talking about, what we're trying to talk about, what we're trying to get at underlying this and we're trying to address is actually the cost of healthcare. And what we know is that preventing poor health is much cheaper than fixing it. And so as we link up the idea of if you have those low incomes, showing up and having to pay out $3 even is significant. I mean, people pay attention to that. And I think that at some level, most of us that, you know, either it's been a long time since we were in that position or maybe we've never been in that position where $12 was a lot of money. I think that, you know, in terms of this doesn't fix all of the issues with the rising cost of healthcare and the cost of healthcare. And it's not saying that we shouldn't explore other avenues of how to hold down cost, but I really do think that we are talking about something significant when we talk about how we've inserted this barrier to getting care. It's hard to get to the doctors. It's hard to remember to take your medication. Nobody likes taking pills, so it's not like we do these things for fun, but then when we add on it this other cost of what might to some people seem very nominal, very minimal, but to others are actual barriers, then we are talking about causing poor health outcomes rather than preventing them. So I think it's worth pursuing, and thanks for the conversation.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. Representative Bonner, and then we'll go on to the next bill. Representative Bonner.
Thanks. You know, and I do think we need to have a much larger conversation about the cost-benefit analysis on these issues. Quite frankly, and Representative Pryor alluded to this, but prevention is often significantly cheaper and has much better outcomes for patients. And I'll give you an example. Obviously, I can tell you about my sister again, who's had diabetes, but I'll tell you about a patient at Hennepin Healthcare, which is a safety net hospital. My mother's worked at the hospital for 43 years. For example, some of the patients that she encounters are low income or almost no income. Some of them are veterans. Some of them are living in the, are part of the BIPOC community. Some of them have various ailments or issues. She had a patient, for example, who came in with diabetes, badly out of control. There were multiple items that could have taken care of that and put his diabetes into better control. But he couldn't afford them. He couldn't even afford the smallest of those things. And so he did not take good care of his diabetes, and it spiraled out of control. The hospital visits racked up, the clinic visits racked up, until eventually he suffered from issues with his feet and had to have an amputation. Now, having an amputation, not only is that extremely expensive, in addition to all of the hospitalization, but now he's permanently disabled, which means that he's going to be using more state services because he can no longer work. So I have to ask, when we talk about the larger picture here, are we actually being penny wise and pound foolish in the way that we talk about prevention and making sure that folks are getting access to the most basic of care to prevent much larger, much more systemic, and much more costly issues down the road? So I want to say thank you to Chair Liebling for bringing this bill forward. It is certainly a topic of hot discussion, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you so much, Representative Bonner. So with that, House File 3365 as amended is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. Thank you for the good conversation, members. And oh, and I do want to thank Representative Schultz because she very kindly found for me some articles and some background research that she helped me with. It's great to have a health economist on call. So thank you, Representative Schultz. Okay, the next bill is House File 3611, Representative Moran.
Well,
welcome to the committee. And Representative Moran, we don't actually have possession of House File 3611, so this is an informational hearing, but we thought your bill was very interesting and fit right in with our plan for today. So please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's good to be back in Health and Human Service Committee. And my friend, Representative Brehagen, your talking points have not changed since 2010 around health care. And so I have another bill in reference to cost sharing out-of-pocket costs. Increases in annual cost sharing or out-of-pocket maximums on health insurance have become the norm over the past 10 years. Currently, they have been as high as $8,700 for an individual or $17,400 for a family. Many Minnesotans with bleeding disorders face prospect of hitting those maximums each and every year. Now, insurance companies are deciding which payment towards a patient bills costs count towards an out-of-pocket maximum. Minnesotans have been stunned to find that they owe money that they have already that has already been collected by the insurance company, but not applied to their maximum out-of-pocket cost calculations. This began in 2016 in Minnesota and is happening to more and more Minnesotans every year. Co-pay assistance has been provided to patients to help them afford the medication they need to control their medical conditions. By denying this to count towards out-of-pocket maximums, otherwise stable patients, Minnesotans, may discontinue treatment leading to serious, even life-threatening complications, which we just heard over and over again. These medications do not have generic equivalents. They are the only ones available to deal with this, with their specific needs. We can help Minnesotans immediately with passage of this legislation and others that we just heard. These patient advocacy groups are also lobbying in Washington, D.C. to enact federal legislation. 12 states have already enacted this type of legislation to help their constituency, and it's time for us to act now. Madam Chair, I believe I do have a couple of testifiers.
Yes, we have a list of them. Thank you very much, Representative Moran, Chair Moran. So I have one, two, three, four people who've asked to testify on this bill, and I would just ask each of you, we are unfortunately running a little behind, but if you could keep your testimony to 2 minutes, we would appreciate that. So first on the list is Jean O'Connell. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jean O'Connell. I'm a board member of the Hemophilia Foundation of Minnesota and the Dakotas. I'm also the sister of four siblings who have hemophilia. And hemophilia is a rare genetic bleeding disorder that affects about 20,000 Americans, and it impairs the ability of blood to clot properly. Without treatment, people with hemophilia bleed internally, and that bleeding can lead to severe joint damage, permanent disability, or even death. Patients depend on prescription medications to treat or avoid painful bleeding episodes, and the current treatment and care are highly effective, and it allows individuals to lead healthy and productive lives. This treatment, however, is extremely expensive, costing anywhere from $250,000 to $1 million a year. It's important to understand that these drugs are not available in generic forms. Monday was Rare Disease Day, and March is Bleeding Disorders Awareness Month. Many Minnesotans with rare diseases are finding that in addition to fighting their disease, they need to fight with their insurance companies about paying for life-saving drugs. There's something called accumulator adjuster programs that started in 2016 and now appear in about 80% of commercial health plans. Copay assistance, which has been discussed before, is money from manufacturers that helps patients afford those out-of-pocket costs for their medications. Patients are using copay assistance to pay for life-saving prescription drugs early in the year. The insurance companies gladly accept those payments, and then they tell Minnesotans that they don't count toward their out-of-pocket maximums. Chair Liebling had indicated that Minnesota has the highest out-of-pocket expense calculations in the nation. So when a family or an individual doesn't have $8,000 to $17,000 to pay out-of-pocket in probably February, they may not receive the medication they need, or they might skip treatments. This can result in people being unable to stabilize their medical condition and end up in the emergency room with an internal bleed that could have been prevented. This bill would eliminate accumulator adjuster programs in Minnesota, and I would ask that you move this legislation forward for a vote in 2022. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. O'Connell. Appreciate your testimony. Next, we have Chris Manns. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and the committee members. My name is Chris Manns. I serve on the HFMD board as well and have 12-year-old twin boys, Evan and Tanner, who have severe hemophilia A. Evan and Tanner take hemophilia medication drugs twice a month to prevent their bleeding episodes. The medicine is administered as a shot, very similar to an insulin shot. This medicine is very effective and allows them to be physically active and live a normal lifestyle. You wouldn't even know they have hemophilia other than the Med Alert bracelet they wear on their wrist. Their hemophilia medication is very expensive and costs approximately $30,000 per month per child. There, as Jean had mentioned, there's no generic drugs available for this disease. I work for a very large Minnesota corporation. My employer only offers high deductible insurance plans for its employees. During 2021, the out-of-pocket family maximum was $10,800, which I meet at the beginning of the plan year with Evan and Tanner's first prescription fill. Because of this large expense, our family relies on patient copay assistance programs provided by the drug manufacturer. Every year, I complete an application form in order to receive this copay assistance. This assistance helps defray the costs associated with the boys' life-saving medications. During 2021 benefit plan year, I learned that my employer changed their health plan and implemented a copay accumulator adjuster program. As a result of this plan change, my employer's insurer accepted the manufacturer assistance of $10,800. However, they did not credit this towards my deductible or out-of-pocket max. Since they did not apply this assistance towards my deductible, I was also responsible for paying the $10,800. So the insurer received the copay assistance plus the amount paid by me. I did not receive any benefit from this copay assistance. I did not want to compromise my boys' treatment, so I ensured I paid this amount. And thankfully, I had enough money set aside in my HSA to cover this amount. If they don't receive their treatment, their risk of having untreated bleeds is very high and would compromise their health. And it could result, as we had talked earlier, in ER visits, which would be much more costly than these medications. This bill would stop the practice of not applying this assistance towards a participant's deductible and would give the benefit of the assistance back to the families where it belongs. I appreciate your time today to hear my story and ask that you consider House File 3611 and move this bill forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Michelle Mack?
Good afternoon, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. My name is Michelle Mack, and I'm a senior director at the Pharmaceutical Care Management Association, PCMA. PCMA represents America's PBMs, or pharmacy benefit managers. We appreciate the opportunity to provide testimony at this informational hearing, and we respectfully oppose House File 3611. I want to emphasize at the onset that PCMA does not oppose the means-tested patients assistance programs that help individuals afford their prescription drugs. There's an important difference between means-tested patient assistance programs and copay coupons, which are targeted to individuals with health insurance. The unfettered price increase of prescription drugs puts patients at risk and health plan sponsors in a very difficult position of either having to cut benefits or increase premiums, copays, and deductibles. While health plans pay the vast amount of their members' prescription drug costs, drug manufacturers' prices increase have forced health plans to create new benefit designs that keep monthly premiums as low as possible. Drug manufacturers encourage patients to disregard formularies and lower cost alternatives by offering coupons to help the patient cover that higher cost. This ultimately steers patients away from cheaper alternatives and towards more expensive brand drugs with higher cost sharing obligations, completely undermining the formulary offered by a plan sponsor. By definition, copay coupons target only those who already have prescription drug coverage and are not means tested. Considered illegal kickbacks in federal health programs, copay coupons are still permitted in the commercial market. Supporters of coupons say that they decrease costs for patients. While they can decrease an individual patient's cost at the pharmacy counter, they do not reduce the actual costs. Copay coupons are temporary. The individual patient likely pays more when the coupon goes away instead of being started on a formulary drug from the start. If drug companies are concerned about patients accessing medications, they should simply lower their prices. Here are just a couple facts when it comes to manufacturer coupons. The prices for drugs with manufacturer coupons increase faster, 20 to 13% per year, compared to non-coupon drugs, 7 to 8% per year. And if Medicare's ban on coupons were not enforced, the cost to that program would increase $48 billion over the next 10 years. Finally, we do have just a question about the effective date of January 1st of 2022, and we're just unsure of how that would be implemented. I thank you for your time and consideration.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Dan Andreessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Thank you for the opportunity to respectfully express our opposition to House File 3611. Plans in the fully insured market do allow enrollees to use manufacturer copay assistance and coupons. However, these are not counted towards payments towards a member's deductible, because the members themselves are not the ones making the payment. A deductible set is a set amount of money the enrollee agrees to pay out of pocket for healthcare expenses. And who is making these payments is especially important when we look at high deductible plans with health savings accounts. Enrollees are granted the tax benefit of an HSA because they're paying all of their deductible. If a third party is paying towards that deductible, this is going to have implication with tax laws governing HSAs. And we agree with the proponent's testimony that prescription drugs cost too much, However, there's nothing in the language in the bill to address the root cause of the problem, and that's what manufacturers charge for their drugs. Now, although manufacturer assistance programs may lower what the enrollee pays at the pharmacy counter, it's not going to lower overall costs, and like Ms. Mack said, ends up contributing to the rising cost of prescription drugs by incentivizing the use of expensive drugs, even though there may be a cheaper alternative or more effective drug on the market. Instead of using funds to create these programs, we would say that manufacturers should instead lower the prices for everyone. I also want to mention that there's a claim that's been made by proponents in their materials that health plans are profiting or double dipping with this program. Health plans do not receive patient assistance funds from a manufacturer. This is a financial arrangement between the manufacturer and the pharmacy to lower what a patient pays at the counter. Any money to buy down out-of-pocket costs goes to the pharmacy. So if there's questions about the collection and use of manufacturer assistance, this should be directed to pharmacists. Lastly, letters and materials from opponents also mention that there's concerns about this program in employer-sponsored health plans. As you know, just want to remind everyone that this bill cannot apply to those plans under federal ERISA law, which preempts states from regulating self-insured market. So in closing, again, we need to tackle the root cause of the problem when it comes to healthcare affordability. And that's, in this case, is what drug manufacturers are charging for their drugs.
All right, Mr. Andreessen, thank you. It's kind of stunning to me that you seem to be all worried about their tax problems. I won't say any more. Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I have a question for Representative Moran. Hi, Representative Moran. Nice to see you again. I do like the part where if an employer gets this by this lady who testified where her employer got the credit or assistance and didn't pass it along to her for her boys, I do think that should be fixed. They shouldn't be able to do that. But I would say this, Representative Moran, is that if we look at the healthcare spending in this country, it's about, in 2020, and you can check this out on the internet, is about $4.2 to $4.3 trillion here in the U.S. The concern is one out of every $3 was bureaucracy, okay? It didn't help the doctor-patient relationship. And Obamacare bloated the bureaucracy. That's why your premiums skyrocketed and your deductible.
Representative Grunhagen, is there a question for Representative Moran? Because we've kind of been through this and we're a little bit on a short time here.
Yeah, the question is coming. So what we need is an option that gets rid of the bureaucracy. And you would see premiums drop dramatically and deductibles drop dramatically. And you'd have choice where to go for patients. That's what we need. So, Representative Moran, do you see and agree that the real problem is the bloating of the bureaucracy that is affecting the doctor-patient relationship?
Madam Chair,
Representative Grunhagen, no. I don't see that as the problem at all. But, you know, with this bill, what we are just trying to simply say that insurance companies and pharmacy benefit managers are refusing to count the copay assistance program payment towards patients' deductibles and out-of-pocket maximums through a practice. They're not counting it. And what we're finding out that this often result in Minnesota realizing that they have been forced to pay thousands of dollars out of pocket just as they thought they had met the annual deductible or the cost sharing limits. And so we believe that that is a practice that is not okay, Representative Grunhagen and members. And I would just stop there.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Representative Moran. This is a very interesting bill. And so we can't lay it over because we don't have the bill. But thank you very much for bringing it to us today. And thank you to all of the testifiers for explaining to us yet another very problematic way that the that patients are being, I would say, mistreated in our system. So thank you so much for coming in today. Next, we're going to take up House File 3280, and this is Representative Freiberg. And again, this is an informational hearing. We do not have the bill before us. So Representative Freiberg, go ahead and introduce us to House File 3280.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for having this discussion about bipartisan legislation that will prevent insurance companies from implementing payer-mandated white bagging. This is a policy that risks medication safety and removes patient and provider choice. White bagging is a fairly new tactic used by health insurers that requires certain complex injectable medications to be purchased through specialty pharmacies that are often owned or vertically integrated with the insurance company, mandating the patient's coverage policy instead of the patient's preferred local healthcare provider. This practice of white bagging can disrupt care for patients with multiple sclerosis, cerebral palsy, cancer, rheumatoid arthritis, rare eye disease, and several other conditions by making these drugs out of network and not covered by a patient's insurance if dispensed by a pharmacy at a local healthcare provider, and requires patients to use an insurer-mandated pharmacy. This insurance mandate interrupts the normal course of treatment, endangers the medication chain of custody, and blocks providers' ability to deliver the best possible care and service to their patients. Under a white bagging arrangement, insurance companies force drugs to be purchased through an insurer's exclusive specialty pharmacy. The drugs are then shipped to a physician's office or hospital facility for administration to a specific patient. This multi-step process interrupts the normal course of treatment and blocks providers' ability to deliver the best possible care and service to their patients. The practice of insurance-mandated white bagging is not only impacting the care of the patient, but leaving providers responsible for medications that they have not compounded, not detailed, have not taken ownership of, and cannot ensure a medication's pedigree. They are then required to store and guarantee the medication's safety when they cannot ensure that the proper handling and shipping of the medication occurred. In many instances, this has led to wasted medications and the additional costs associated with handling a white-bagged drug for a patient. White bagging creates risks for patients across Minnesota by sourcing drugs outside the normal supply chain and quality control process, and creates delays in medication administration that significantly affect patient health. In a recent survey by healthcare consulting firm Vizient Incorporated, 83% of hospitals said that specialty medications delivered to them for patient administration through white bagging did not arrive on time. And another 66% of hospitals said that they have received the wrong dose. Worse, sometimes a clinic or hospital pharmacy is prescribed medication in stock and ready to be administered when the patient arrives for their scheduled infusion or injection, only to be told the medication has not arrived or is not even in stock from the insurance-mandated specialty pharmacy. For many reasons, but most importantly for the patients who need these complex medications at a time in clinic, infusion center, or hospital that the providers decide, I urge you to help me pass this bipartisan legislation. And I think there's a few people who are testifying in support of it, as well as a couple who aren't quite as high on it.
Okay. Okay, Representative Freiberg, thank you. So we do have a list of testifiers, and we don't have a lot of time, so about 15 minutes. So please be brief, testifiers, if you would. So first is Dr. Paul Thermes. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Vice Chair, and members of the House Health Finance Committee. My name is Dr. Paul Thermes, and I am a medical oncologist and practice medical director for Minnesota Oncology. We're an oncology practice with 12 locations in the Twin Cities. I am speaking to you this afternoon on behalf of Minnesota Oncology in support of HF 3280. As a practicing oncologist, I have one goal for all of my patients with cancer, that they receive the care they need in a manner that minimizes stress and anxiety and allows them to continue living with the highest quality of life. My care philosophy is this: we plan treatment around life, not life around treatment. The ability to manage infusion drug inventory and real-time dosing for our patients with cancer has always been the standard practice for community cancer care. This has been accomplished through a closed chain distribution system that ensures that the medication arrives safely and on time. Because we currently prepare these chemotherapy drugs on site and in our office to the exact specifications of each individual patient's needs, we can dispense a safe and appropriate dose to the patient in real time. I can adjust a patient's treatment today based on today's laboratory values, side effects, disease status, or patient preference today. With our current care model, we can help our patient plan chemotherapy around life, not life around chemotherapy. As an oncologist, my main concerns are my patient's care, quality of life, convenience, and being able to keep their cancer treatment on schedule. As a medical director for a large practice, I am most concerned about drug product integrity, verification of source, minimizing staff burden and burnout, and overseeing patient safety. White bagging mandates threaten to upend all of these. Let's take delays. If a patient needs an adjustment to their dose based on labs or toxicity or quality of life, white bagging would mean that the patient would simply have to come back to clinic at a later date. If the drug is late or doesn't arrive at all from the off-site pharmacy, the patient's treatment is further delayed. This is a setup for bad patient care. Safety. We would have no control over supply, product integrity, and schedule of delivery. As a medical director, this is my responsibility for our group, and I want to be able to do more than cross my fingers and hope for the best.
Dr. Thomas, I have to ask you to wrap up, please.
Sure. Staff burden and burnout, it's just really hard to manage inventory when we don't know when it's coming and if it arrives on time. And also waste. Unused white bagging drug cannot be redispensed, and it becomes simply medical toxic waste. So it's just really a stressful time for patients. Cancer care is so much more than receiving chemotherapy from a white bag hanging on an IV pole. White bagging is just a bad idea. It delays patient care. It makes patients have to come back to clinic. And it is just not good for patient care. And for these reasons, we respectfully request support for HF 3280. Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much. Okay, Brenda Reinhart, and please do be brief because we'll run out of time and I'll have to skip the next one person in support if we don't have time for the opponent. So, Ms. Reinhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will be brief. My name is Brenda Reinhart, and I work with vitreoretinal surgery. We are a group of ophthalmologists who are subspecialized in the back of the eye. We treat diseases of the retina, vitreous, and macula. We often are treating diseases, blinding diseases, such as macular degeneration and diabetic retinopathy. It is not unusual for our patients to come into our office needing an injection every 4 to 6 weeks. I just want to give you 4 very brief examples of what we've experienced with white bagging. We have our first patient who we found out on November 1st had a change of insurance. We would need to get their drug through a specialty pharmacy. We called the next day. We got an authorization, a prior authorization. It wasn't until December 28th that we received a call from the specialty pharmacy. He told us that we should go ahead and buy and bill, which means take stock out of our refrigerators and inject it. We said, no, we do know that this health plan requires that we get it from a specialty pharmacy. Then he said, let's go ahead and send that drug to the patient's house. Now, these drugs need to be maintained at a temperature controlled. It's very important that we not let it get too warm or too cold. We would never, ever inject into someone's eye a drug that was sent to a patient's house. I will fast forward through the rest of it. We've had multiple conversations. After 4 months, 3 different phone calls from specialty pharmacies that where we were told to get the drug here, there, whatnot. 4 months, 3 calls, numerous phone calls. We still today do not have that drug for that patient. Second patient I want to bring up, we were informed the end of December that we needed to obtain the drug from specialty pharmacy. They were unable. It was December 28th. We could not order that drug for that patient. So we had to wait until December 30th. On December 30th, we tried to obtain it. We called back on January 14th, and they said, well, they needed consent from the patient. Now, please keep in mind, we've already received a prior authorization. That was handled in the middle of December. Then when we called back, so they couldn't reach the patient for consent. We called the patient. We got consent, told them, please call, get the consent going. On January 28th, we were told that drug was now out of stock. They said it would be 2 to 3 days. February 1st, we called. They said the drug was still out of stock, and it would be 1 to 2 weeks. February 22nd.
Okay, Ms. Reinhardt, I think we really do get the picture, but I'm sorry, we just won't have time to go through the whole thing. Do you want to say a final sentence?
I just want to say that every one of these is difficult. We should not have to be informing the specialty pharmacy of their policies. They need to, when we have a refrigerator full of drugs, we should be able to treat our patients. We will never let our patients not get injections because of the administrative burdens put in front of us. I appreciate your time and listening to our my comments.
Thank you very much. Scott, Sophie?
Yeah, hi, Scott Sefti. I'm the Director of Pharmacy Cancer Care Services at the Mayo Clinic, and I will be extremely brief because you've heard basically what I was going to say. This process disrupts the supply chain. The supply chain at Mayo is a very secure supply chain. We actually refuse to buy from some providers because of histories of poor quality. And the white bagging process, we lose total control of the supply chain. Patient disruption, patient harm, delays in care. And the final thing is these drugs are all now shifted to the pharmacy benefit. So there's added burden on the patients financially. There's an increased cost sharing to them because all of these drugs are going to cost more on the patients on the pharmacy side. So we strongly support this bill and would recommend that you support House Bill 3280.
All right. Thank you very much. Sergio Santaviago.
Hey, good afternoon, and thank you for having us. My name is Sergio Santaviago, and I appreciate the Spanish pronunciation of my name, Sergio, but we'll go with Sergio here just for convenience. I'm Vice President of Drug Policy for AHIP. We're a national association whose members provide coverage for healthcare-related services to millions of Americans every day. We believe Americans deserve access to comprehensive, quality, affordable coverage, and AHIP is committed to advancing policy solutions that are market-based in support of those goals. I thank you for this opportunity to speak, and we are here to share our serious concerns with and opposition to House File 3280. The problem has long been and still is the price of drugs. There are many innovative strategies being used, including white and brown bagging through specialty pharmacies to help reduce some of the costs for these very high-priced drugs. As you know, under white bagging, the specialty pharmacy delivers the drug directly to the physician or hospital setting or home setting, depending on the arrangements that are made for the patient. And the insurer pays only for the negotiated fee for services of administering the medication in that setting. You're not paying for the ingredient cost. And that's an important thing to consider here. I have a whole lot of other things I'd be happy to talk about, but one of the reasons why especially pharmacies have jumped into this role is because there is no incentive to reduce the price of drugs or acquire the cost of these drugs at a competitive cost. Most physicians and hospital groups are being reimbursed for the full price of the drug, plus a percentage of that price on top of the drug to pay for their physician services for actually administering the drug. Therefore, the more the drug costs, the more they get paid. And this is not to suggest that they are trying to scam anyone or anything else. It's just a reality that they are not sensitive to drug prices. Unfortunately, patients and plan sponsors are very susceptible and very sensitive to drug prices. It's been well documented in a number of studies, and AHIP has conducted its own research that finds that hospitals and physician groups will increase the price of these drugs from 100 to 800% above Medicare's rates. Our own research has found that the average physician group markup per drug for a single treatment is about $1,429 over the specialty pharmacy's acquisition price, and that the average hospital markup is $7,069 over the acquisition cost for specialty pharmacies. So what this is really about is the need to introduce some competition into purchasing practices and reducing the acquisition costs of these drugs so that patients and plan sponsors can afford them. And then one other note quickly, if I may, about safety. I've heard a number of witnesses suggest that these drugs are acquired outside of the drug supply chain. This is utterly false. Specialty pharmacies acquire their drugs under the same rules and requirements of the Drug Supply Chain Safety and Security Act. They also follow United States Pharmacopeia standards for quality and safety. They operate just like any other pharmacy in which they dispense the prescription drug as written. And ideally, under this process, if there is full cooperation from the physician or hospital setting, the patient should never know where the drug is coming from, only that they are going to go to their prescribed time or their set aside time for their treatment, and they will receive their drug. Okay. So I'm happy to take your questions.
All right. Thank you. All right. Mr. Andreessen, and we are running out of time, so please go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Dan Andreessen with the Council of Health Plans. I'll be really quick. We are opposed to the current version of this bill. Our plans on the fully insured market do not have white bagging arrangements. And if this does happen, it's usually because providers ask for it because they don't have the ability to store these medications on site. But we do oppose the idea of prohibiting plans from potentially using this tool in the future to mitigate drug costs, as a previous testifier just mentioned. We are concerned about hospital markups, but also about language in the bill on lines 2.27 to 2.29. It states that a health plan has to reimburse a hospital pharmacy at a rate that's the same or higher than a specialty pharmacy. That's going to add cost to patients. And we've also heard concerns about transportation's delivery of safety of medications. Language in the bill doesn't create any new requirements for these entities. Section 1 of Subdivision 5 only instructs entities to currently follow U.S. code. So if there's issues with transport and delivery, then we should certainly examine this and look at those entities. And I'll also encourage providers to evaluate their processes for receiving these drugs. But at this time, we have to be opposed. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Michelle Mack.
Good afternoon, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. Michelle Mack again from PCMA. We appreciate the opportunity to testify on this bill, and unfortunately, we respectfully oppose the bill. PBMs and their health plan and employer clients use specialty pharmacies to deliver high-quality, accessible pharmacy services while promoting product affordability. And the flexibility to continue contracting with these select pharmacies is the key to ensuring access and promoting affordability in Minnesota. When an employer or a health plan decides to contract with a PBM to administer their pharmacy benefit, they maintain authority over the terms and benefit plan design, including how drugs should be obtained by or delivered to beneficiaries. The employer or plan, not the PBM, makes decisions regarding cost-sharing requirements, formularies, and networks, including the use of mail delivery of a drug to a patient or provider. In limiting a plan sponsors to allow white bag to prohibit white bagging, this bill will substantially increase costs for Minnesota consumers and plan sponsors. Our research shows that in the first year alone, restricting white bagging will cost Minnesotans $175 million in excess drug spending. While the vast majority of prescription drugs do not require special handling or packaging, for those that do, mail service pharmacies use U.S. Pharmacopeia guidelines to determine handling needs and leverage proprietary software to map out the ideal packaging journey. Like the precautions taken with the COVID vaccines moving through cold chain, specialty pharmacies manage specialty drugs in a similar manner to ensure drugs do not spoil. The precision also reflects the needs and preferences of consumers, not only for safe, high-quality products, but also to know when their prescription will be shipped and received. Specialty pharmacies and mail delivery are tools used in the pharmacy networks because they ensure high-quality drug delivery service, avoid waste, and ensure appropriate use of the medications.
Ms. Mack, you have 30 seconds. Okay, good.
Thank you for your time.
You are welcome. Thank you. Representative Bierman. You are muted.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I know this was just informational, so it'll be coming back, but I would just ask all the people that testified, we just had a question after question with everybody that testified today. So I guess I have a few that I would just like people to come back with the answers to the questions. When we are looking at medication that is being delivered in a facility that is in network, how can the medication not also be in network? And when the medical benefit shifts to a pharmacy benefit, that's a concern. So I just want to know how much more that's costing consumers. The whole chain of the product, you know, we heard from three or four people who said it was adequate, and then we heard from people who said it wasn't. We need to know more about that as well. So just a lot of questions. The more people that talk, the more questions that come up on this bill. And I think we need some answers to those prior to starting again fresh without people being prepared for those answers. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. Representative Freiberg, and we can go just a very few minutes over, which is what we're going to do. Representative Freiberg, do you want to have a final word?
Sure. Well, I thought Representative Bierman made some very good points, you know, particularly about the distinction between a medical benefit and a pharmacy benefit. And it goes to what some of the testifiers were saying. I mean, under a medical benefit, many patients have fixed visit copays and out-of-pocket maximums. Pharmacy benefits can have higher copays and often do not have an out-of-pocket maximum structure, and that can lead to significantly increased cost to the patient. So, you know, I'm happy to continue to work with people who have concerns with the bill. I've met with a couple of them already. All in all, I think it's a good bill that addresses an important issue, and a lot of people would benefit from it. I think we heard that from the testifiers in support. But seeing as this is an informational hearing, sort of continue the discussion.
Thank you very much, Representative Freiberg. And thank you to all the testifiers. I'm sorry I had to rush you, many of you, but I would just say this, as someone who doesn't really have a dog in the fight, and I don't know a whole lot about this issue, I have to say that my impression from all of this is that there are real problems with this practice, but perhaps the bill isn't hitting the right solution. I agree with Representative Bierman, there's a lot more for us to understand about this, but it seems to me there should be some solution, because the concerns that have been expressed by the physicians, I think, are extremely real and serious. And nevertheless, the cost considerations are also real and serious. So it seems like smart people should be able to get together and work on this and figure out something that will work. And I hope that, and under Representative Freiberg's able guidance, I hope you'll be able to come up with something. So, with that, thank you again to the testifiers, and it's been a very interesting hearing. Thank you, members, for your participation. And with that, we are adjourned.